Hello, everybody. So we're Catherine Ashley and Vito Margoshka, and we've been working together on and off for a long period of time. The paper we're going to present has a slightly different title, but that's traditional, isn't it, from what we originally planned, which is up here. And this is the title of a paper that Vita and I have written, which is coming out shortly in this new journal, the European Journal of Gender and Politics. Politics and Gender. Did I get it wrong?
Yeah.
EJGPG. Anyway, yes. But this is part of a larger project that we're trying to get off the ground on the theme of feminism in and against neoliberalism. So I thought it might be helpful to start with a bit of personal intellectual background, because I think we're all coming from different places in this conversation. So Beecher and I both have a disciplinary location in politics and international relations, and we have an ongoing interest in, amongst other things, the economic context of and critiques of feminist activism, particularly theorised in terms of social movement politics. So we spent the first decade of the 2000s, a very long decade for us, preoccupied with the global justice movement. So this was our project for a long time, where we were trying to develop a feminist lens on anti-globalisation or the global justice movement, and engaging with both sociological and IR scholarship, which we argued functioned to erase the activities and insights of feminist activists. And part of that project involved... sorry, I forgot to put my timer on. So part of that project involved an empirical study of what we called feminist anti-globalisation activism in different countries. But our work since has moved in different directions, but the interest is still there. So, for instance, one of my recent projects is on trying to make feminist sense of protest camps, and I've been looking at the Occupy movement. Beecher has been studying various strands of left-wing anti-austerity organising in the UK, and particularly around Corbynism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With Jonathan.
When we started working on this current collaboration, we had a belated realisation that there is both a disjuncture and continuity with our past and present work. That the global justice movement may have dissipated, anyway, as a frame of intellectual analysis, no longer be an appropriate way of thinking about feminist organising. However, in fact, we're still studying the same kind of people and the same kind of struggles. In fact, very often the same people and the same struggles, protesting the same economic formations and logics. So in other words, we are still concerned, at least in part, with feminist resistances to neoliberal capitalism and its intersection with gendered, racialized, and geopolitical hierarchies. And indeed, it seems to us more important than ever to study these resistances and to work out how to conceptualize them and their changing forms in a context where the global justice movement may be no more, but neoliberal capitalism, as we've heard, certainly has not gone away. So all of which is to say that we are coming more from the resistance side of things. That's right, Sally. So to try and speak in more impersonal terms about the rationale for the current project. So our starting point really is the surge in claims post-2008 that neoliberalism has accelerated and intensified and or, these things may be connected, in some kind of crisis. So I've been gathering this kind of literature for a while and wondering what to make of it. And then thinking that there is some kind of connection here, that this is the context in which we've seen this remarkable growth in literature about the co-optation of feminist organising. So feminism, as we've heard, is increasingly seen as being made and remade or undone in neoliberal forms by neoliberalism. There are also ongoing efforts to try and chart feminist resistances, but these seem to us more marginal in this discursive terrain within feminism, which is more concerned nowadays with co-optation dynamics. So our new project, Feminism In and Against Neoliberalism, is trying to take both co-optation and resistance seriously. So we're trying to pay more attention to the co-optation side of the debate while also bringing the resistance stuff firmly into the centre of analysis, because we want thereby to try and think about, rethink the possibilities and dangers facing feminists today. So, which brings me to the paper that we're presenting today. So this was written for the European Journal of Gender and Politics as a what they call a state-of-the-art review piece. So basically it's, for a large part, a kind of literature review, a very opinionated one. And it takes a broad, very broad brush approach, surveys a wide range of literature. It's trying to identify the main narratives in this literature and their discursive effects, rather than engage in detail with individual pieces which may have very many merits that we're going to gloss over a bit today. So just, I guess I'm getting my apologies in early if there are people here who feel that we're misrepresenting the subtleties of your individual arguments. We're trying to look at the overall political effects. So parts one and two of the paper are effectively a literature review. So, and we lay out what we see as the main co-optation and resistance narratives in feminism, feminist academic work, drawing out with each how they depict neoliberalism, what feminism is, and where feminist activism takes place. And then in the third part of the paper, we try and develop alternative ways of thinking about feminism and neoliberalism, which Beecher will run through in a moment. So, just briefly, I'm going to kind of run through or trying to summarise our arguments for you in this part of the paper. So, the first part of the paper begins with what we call the strong, and others have called the strong co-optation thesis. So, this has long roots in parallel arguments about the dangers of feminist engagements with the state and also fears about NGOisation. So, these are longer literatures in play here. But in our view, it seemed to crystallise around 2009 in a whole series of very high-profile articles, notably the Nancy Fraser piece, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and on which Beecher and I wrote a critique before in political studies. But so we're revisiting our criticisms in that paper and trying to reframe them somewhat. So just to summarise, we argue that the strong co-optation thesis in effect has a rather totalising and monolithic view of neoliberalism as emanating from the north and spreading to the south. It also has a kind of disciplinary dynamic in the way that feminism is dissected into good girls and bad girls. So good girls are basically, we argue in most of this literature, there's a nostalgic attachment to second wave socialist feminism, which is kind of under-justified. And the bad girls are liberal feminism, third wave feminism, so-called identity politics, and in effect a whole range of cross-cutting feminist activism or alternative feminist actors or movements are missing from these analyses. And we argue also there that this discourse produces a rather determinist view of institutional sites of activism, especially in relation to southern feminist NGOs. So we're not very sympathetic to this view. We're much more sympathetic to what we see as a much more nuanced argument about co-optation, which we're going to hear lots of today. So it was partly sort of reading more and more of this literature that made me convinced that we need to take this argument more seriously than certainly Beecher and I have done in the past. So this approach, this more nuanced account of co-optation, has a view of neoliberalism as producing contradictory effects, and I think Kalpana articulated that very clearly. It thus gives us a more differentiated and site-specific account of the myriad forms of co-opted feminism, and it allows for the possibilities of contestation and ambiguity, at least to some extent, in institutionalised sites of activism. However, we think, or we're concerned, that the good girl, bad girl binary is still at work here. And with the former, the good girl, the left largely implicit and unspecified, although we can assume that she largely operates outside of institutions. And again, although I think Kalpana's work actually moves in the kind of direction we're arguing for, it doesn't give enough attention to the agency of women in the global south, so it's that kind of work that we're arguing for. The second part of the paper, I don't know if you can see behind my head, focuses on what we call this emergent counter-narrative of resistance. So again, you know, there are long-standing resistance narratives in feminism. There's enormous literature tracking opposition to neoliberal and structural adjustment policies. And I think we'd put our own research on global justice movement in this kind of tradition as well. But we're focusing here specifically on work that's seeking to respond to co-optation arguments by saying, well, look at this resistance, by recovering feminist oppositional activism. And this work, we say, is extremely useful because it focuses on the intersectional micro-level effects of neoliberalism. It brings a whole range of feminist strands of activism into view, which we don't otherwise see, and it pays very close attention to extra-institutional sites where such activism may take place. So unlike the other two narratives, this literature hones in on feminist resistance, i.e. the good girls. But again, we're still lacking criteria by which we're supposed to judge some feminism good and other feminists bad. And yet again, as well, we've got this institutional and extra-institutional binary in play. So where does this leave us? Beecher's going to tell us. Main argument. There you go.
And so it falls to me to give you, to deliver the really opinionated bit of the article. So let's see how this goes. Okay, so our overall argument in the paper, at least thus far, is that taken together, the cumulative effect, or if you prefer, the formative effect of the narratives that we review in this article, serves to split feminism into co-opted and resistant faces, with each side gaining its meaning and content from the other. More concretely, feminism becomes parsed, as Catherine just said, into bad girls versus good girls, with the former being buried deep in institutional settings, global governance settings, and the latter freed up to resist in spaces of so-called grassroots activism. Indeed, we even find, we suggest in the article, an implicit binary shaping the core subjects under discussion, in other words, feminism and neoliberalism, to the extent that these two forces are depicted as discrete forms of agency, pitted against each other in a kind of zero-sum battle in which feminism is either, these are our choices, consumed or overwhelmed by its foe, or deemed to be beyond its clutches, pure. So in response to this setup, this binary logic, we try to start a conversation in the last part of the paper about how we might go beyond what feels to us a very inflexible, tight dyadic logic that has crept into our self-assessments of our feminist futures. And to this end, we revisit the feminist subject, the appropriate site of feminist activism, and the force of neoliberalism in an attempt, and it's a very preliminary one, to open up our conceptions of each one. So I don't have that much time, so I'm going to focus in on how we try to reclaim feminist subject, because I think it will be the most controversial bit of the paper. And we'll see what you think. And then I'll quickly run through the other two. Okay, so turning to the feminist subject first. We argue that the first thing we need to do is to reclaim feminism as a left political project with all its ambiguities and contradictions. In other words, we go along with Wood and Litherland when they state, thanks Maria, and I'm going to quote, that feminism is not endlessly flexible, meaning all things to all people, but nor is it a fixed set of agreed upon principles to which every person, text, or movement that labels itself feminist must adhere to be approved. So how do we navigate that definition? Okay. So by defining it as an exemplar of left politics, we seek to reground feminism in an egalitarian ethos, which is animated by a moral objection to unjustifiable inequalities and a desire to rectify them. By arguing this, we are drawing on the work of Roberto Bobbio and Stephen Luks, who defend an expansive conception of left, which embraces not only traditional feminism and Marxism, although they're part of the team, whether we like it or not sometimes, but also a wide range of egalitarian movements, including all strands of feminism. So situating feminism firmly on the left for us allows us to make several moves, four to be specific. First, in our view, it allows us to redraw the boundaries around feminism in a far more ample and generous way, so that it now includes a wide variety of activisms from anarchist to queer and from socialist to green, despite the obvious tensions between them. Moreover, it enables us to confidently embrace, we think, much of what is now described as liberal feminism. In this way, we want to agree with or learn from the insightful work of Catherine Rottenberg, who has argued... Where's Catherine? Thank you, Catherine. Who has argued that liberal feminism has always offered an imminent critique of the dominant order in light of a commitment to equality, and that we shouldn't forget that. Now, having reminded ourselves that we share a commitment to egalitarianism and we're all motivated by a collective desire to rectify social injustice... Seeing feminism as a left project also explicitly pushes us to recenter the theory and practice of intersectionality as both a normative aspiration and a political imperative of any feminist politics, and indeed of the left more widely. Interestingly, Stephen Luks actually explicitly says this in his definition of left. That left, he says, must be what he calls cross-boundary. Right? You cannot be left and only focus on class, or only focus on gender. This is because, as we know, inequalities are cross-cutting and mutually reinforcing. It's our worry, it's just a worry, and I think with this worry we agree with Grewal, Indira Grewal, that the language of co-optation, whatever the intent, serves to make it actually harder to see and think intersectionally, precisely because narratives of co-optation reproduce and evoke a singular or pure feminist subject organized around a single vector of gender. Third, if feminism in all its varieties is understood as speaking to and from left political project, then I think we can see more easily, or we can defend more easily, the claim that at least in terms of its intent, its rationale, its purpose, it embodies by definition a form of resistance to neoliberalism and its attendant social, political, and economic inequalities. And this is a bit controversial, but I'll say it. So from this perspective, Catherine, Kalpana, I don't know what you think, it seems to us that the term neoliberal feminism, or transnational business feminism, or market feminism, take your pick of the bad girl, may run the risk of being an oxymoron. We're not saying the phenomena associated with this notion doesn't exist. Yes, it does. And Kalpana, you've given us a rich exemplar of how it works. But rather, what we're suggesting is that as feminists, we may not want to see the label feminism that easily. Maybe we can simply call it something else. In other words, we're suggesting that rather than draw the boundary between good feminists and bad feminists, well, we prefer anyway to hold the line between feminist and non-feminist. Last but not least, if feminism is understood as a distinct left political project, albeit a contested and multi-layered one, we also think we might be in a better position to disentangle two processes that, in our view, have become conflated in the literature. And these processes are co-optation on the one hand and appropriation on the other. So for us, co-optation implies a process of conversion, a process of conversion or derailment in which feminist agents, self-identified feminist agents, are drafted to actively contribute to projects that are not of their own making. Appropriation, on the other hand, is somewhat different, as it involves the hijacking or instrumentalization of something that is produced by others without their knowledge or even approval. So while the former, co-optation, requires the participation, witting or unwitting, conscious or unconscious, of self-identified feminist subjects, the latter makes no such demands and can occur and be undertaken without a feminist insight. For this reason, cunning forms of appropriation, which I think, Kalpana, you've captured wonderfully, by neoliberal forces, quite possibly pose a far more complex challenge than does co-optation. After all, if we listen to the wealth of feminist research into feminist social movements, as well as feminists within organizations, we know that feminists are just not that easy to co-opt. But finding ways of thwarting the misappropriation of feminist discourses, images, and ideas requires constant vigilance and pushback, a task that can only be undertaken if we are confident about what feminism is for and against, and are willing and able to say so loudly in definitive terms. And just before I end this sort of these statements, these assertions about the feminist subject, I want to add one final methodological caveat to the argument regarding the need to conceptualize the feminist subject, which is that we recognize that locating feminism on the left tells us absolutely zero, nothing, about either the political practices that it enacts in a particular place and time, or the consequences of those actions, whether they're intended or unintended, good or bad. Thus, arguably, feminist-inspired practice can result in what some will see as non-feminist outcomes. Conversely, as Elizabeth Prugel has wonderfully depicted in her own work, a decidedly non-feminist corporate-sponsored project designed to, I think it was, increase the sales of soap to women, can actually create productive openings for the collective empowerment of those women. So as we go forward with our research on feminist organizing, it's imperative, in our view, that we distinguish between intent, practice, and impact, and reflect far more explicitly than we currently do on the possible criteria for evaluating each of them in their own terms when making judgments about the potential progressive or emancipatory nature of any particular feminist engagement. And we can talk more about that if you want in Q&A. Okay, moving on from the feminist subject to the space where it's enacted, we suggest that one way of complicating the inside-outside dichotomy that for some reason seems to have crept back into our discourses is to... is to reacquaint ourselves with very long-standing feminist insights on the question of organizational politics and its relationship to social movements. In fact, going back as far back as the 1990s, feminist sociologists and political scientists such as Mira Marks-Ferry and Patricia Martin have been arguing against any such juxtaposition between social movements and organizations. In fact, they highlight the fact that the former, social movements, are almost always comprised by some form of the latter. And they go on to demonstrate that institutionalization in and of itself does not necessarily spell de-radicalization. So they point out, well, the tactics may change, the goals do not necessarily. Moreover, they suggest that both hierarchical and participatory modes of organizing, while obviously different, have unintended effects which militate against any form of generalization about the merits of either one. Another more recent body of literature, feminist social movement studies, makes very similar kinds of arguments. And they've suggested that even the most self-consciously radical feminist manifestations can reproduce exclusions. We know this. So here are even the work of Joe Freeman, the long-standing work of Joe Freeman on the tyranny of structurelessness, the work of Pauletta on feminist movements in the United States, all testify to this knowledge. Finally, we also point to the emergence of feminist institutionalism, which insists on seeing institutions as comprising both formal and informal rules, an insight that complicates any effort to sustain any clear boundary between institutional and extra-institutional politics. So basically, the story is we know better. We know that these binaries, the inside-outside, the institution versus social movement, doesn't hold water, particularly when feminist activists get into that space. So we need to remember that. Finally, we end the paper, and I think Maria will be happy with this, or Maria's professor who has the list about neoliberalism will be happy about this. But trying to suggest that one way of disarming neoliberalism and granting it a lot less power than we currently do in this body of literature is by reconceptualizing it as a more disaggregated, contingent, and contradictory force. So here we look at the work of Gripson and Graham, amongst others, who explain that, quote, "It is the way that capitalism has been thought that has made it so difficult to imagine its supersession. In an attempt to dissolve its ontological integrity, they draw on post-structural and post-Marxist insights, and they suggest that the economic realm would be better understood as embodying multiple and diverse social relations organized around plural identities. In other words, we cannot reduce it to a market logic. In their view, and we agree, reconfiguring neoliberal capitalism as a site of fluid, networked social interactions opens up space to look for resistance, alterity, and even feminist possibilities. These collective and individual efforts, of course, cannot be seen as untainted by capitalist relations, but rather we're suggesting they need to be understood as emerging from and speaking back to specific renditions of power and exclusion within a capitalist context. In other words, the picture we're trying to paint here is of resistance bubbling up within or in the middle of capitalist relations, then somehow emanating from outside of it. So in sum, with 40 seconds left, we hope that re-envisaging feminism as a collective left-wing struggle manifested in a range of sites and entangled within, but never entirely captured by neoliberal power relations, might help us hold our nerve. And remember that we share a political project that's worth defending. I'm sounding a bit moralistic here. One that feminists across the globe continue to pursue despite some of our claims to the contrary. Thanks.